Coming up on today's show...
You know those lanyards you wear around at those conferences with your name on it and stuff? We went over and pulled the one off my brother and he threw it on the floor. And he looked at us and in his kind of, you know, my terrible British accent, he goes, first of all, you don't come to them. You go home and write great songs and make them come to you.
Welcome to another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, featuring interviews with guests who are having success in entertainment, primarily music. I am Bruce Wozniak, talking to guests who are singers, songwriters, musicians, recording artists, and more from the worldwide music community. Get in touch with me by writing to podcast@nhte.net, or instead of email, you can DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account. Joining me today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from just outside of Nashville, my guest is a multi-Juno Award-winning songwriter and producer. He is the founder of Sundown Sessions Studios and the founder and CEO of Sync Songwriter, with five songs from two Sync Songwriter alumni artists having recently been featured in a Cannes Palme d'Or winning film. He has produced numerous hit songs for radio, including gold and platinum records, for several major label artists. His credits include working with Blue Rodeo, plus working on albums by major artists like Kris Kristofferson and Bryan Adams, among others. There is a free online live event coming up this Sunday, January 12th, that he will tell you about during our conversation today. You've been hearing a song he produced called Change of Heart. Welcome to Now Hear This Entertainment, Kris SD.
Yeah, thanks so much, Bruce. Really appreciate you having me on here.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you for making time to speak with me. Let's get started by having you share about the song that was just playing called Change of Heart, in terms of your role with that, who the artist was, what the song is about, whatever you'd like to tell us about that track.
This was an artist named Rob Larkin and the Wayward Ones, and a song of his, Change of Heart. And I've worked with him. He's gotten, you know, several sync placements in shows and in movies, and this particular one, he came to me and asked me to help produce it for him, and so we went ahead and produced it. And I remember telling him, you know, I think we should take more of a Tom Petty vibe with this one. He's like, okay, that sounds cool. So that's kind of what we did, and it worked out great and got into a show.
I like that you said that about, I think we should take more of a Tom Petty vibe with it, because I'm always interested to hear from producers to what extent they do flex their producer muscle, if you will, and tell the artist, okay, I like what you've got here, but in a way that hopefully the artist understands, you're trying to get the best possible song for them, and it's not being said critically. And so I do wonder, when he brought that song to you, what shape it was in versus what we just ended up hearing.
Yeah. So Rob is a talented songwriter, and I've worked with him before in the past. And so one of the advantages I have, besides that familiarity with them, is that the studio I've been doing this for 20 plus years producing records, and one advantage I have with my new studio, Sundown Session Studio, it's online and it is much more geared towards a production studio. So people come to me with music that's really to kind of use the talents that we have on the production team. And we've got some, you know, amazing talent, and we really are about sort of helping people take their song from where it is to somewhere else. And we're not so much like a, you know, more of a, you know, brick and mortar studio where somebody comes in and they dictate everything. If they want to do 19 guitar takes, that's what they do. We're much more in the driver's seat with it. And we literally tell people, like, hey, if you need to, you know, nitpick every little thing and you don't need people like us, go into a studio and do it yourself.
I see.
You know, I use a lot of world-class talent at the studio to really raise songs up to, you know, basically broadcast ready, things that are going to work, can get on radio and get on TV and film. And we have a fairly big, you know, part in that. And we don't dictate everything, certainly, but we have a pretty strong sort of push for that.
Well, for those just being introduced to you for the first time, Kris, let's do some background setting. I would love to hear the story about you being in a band as a teenager and transitioning to music production. Oh, by the way, a long way geographically from where you are today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So basically, you know, I was probably like a regular teenager coming up in the late 80s. And I would sort of come home. I remember, you know, I didn't have like, you know, a Walkman or like any sort of headset or anything at the time. And I'd come home and I would, you know, had a couple of Led Zeppelin records and Beatles and stuff. And I would turn the speakers of my parents' Pioneer stereo sort of in towards each other, put them close together like headphones, and I'd sort of lie down in between them and play music. And that was sort of my thing, you know, Tchaikovsky, Montoya, flamenco, stuff like that.
Wow.
I was hearing mostly woofer, obviously. The tweeters were a long way from my ears. But that was kind of my musical sort of, you know, and deciding to get into music and get into a band. Formed a band with my brother, and we had, you know, great success in the sort of Ottawa, sort of northern U.S., Ontario area. We toured across the country a couple times. We got Ahmet Erdogan from Atlantic Records to come out to one of our shows just before he died. You know, the founder of Atlantic, he signed Led Zeppelin and signed Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and a bunch of others. And so that was, you know, there was a couple of really cool stories there. But the transition to music production really happened after the band broke up, you know, amicably. We were just two different writers, you know. And I was always curious about the black art of music production. Like, how do they get those sounds? You know, how do they make a vocal sound this way? How do you get that kind of drum sound?
Well, wait a minute. Had your band recorded anything, or you were just out playing covers?
Yeah, so we were in the studio with very talented producers sometimes, or, you know, engineers at the very least. So we knew kind of how that worked, right? You know, how to mic things up and do that stuff. But it was like, how do you make decisions, you know, with that kind of stuff?
Wow.
So if you're after a certain drum sound, how do you do that? You later find out it all the ingredients matter, you know, the type of drums you're using, the room that it's in, the drummer you're using, the microphones you're using, how you're recording it. You know, there's all of these sort of a recipe, you know, you've got to have the right ingredients and then the right types of those ingredients. Are you using fresh thyme or using dry thyme? And, you know, there's all these things that affect it. And that was the part that really, you know, those magical records we've all heard and we're just like, my gosh, you know, how did they come up with that? Or how did they get that sound? That was the part I was after. Not so much the mechanical, but the muse.
Two follow-up questions. Number one, what age might you have been during the period you just described? And number two, just to back up to where you said that your band actually toured the country, I'm assuming you mean Canada.
Yes, yeah. We went across Canada in an old van and lived on the road and stuff. And, you know, I was in my, like, you know, early, mid-20s during that period.
Okay.
And so I think the band broke up probably when I was about 25 or 26, maybe, something like that. And then, yeah, I got into music production and was recording my friends for beer, and that's how it started.
And then you eventually relocated to Toronto and, I believe, worked for 9 years in a studio and a role that put you on the front line with some really notable artists. Tell us about that time, including how you got that opportunity.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, when we moved to Toronto from Ottawa, where I was.
We being who? Who moved from Ottawa to Toronto? Your family or just you?
My girlfriend and I, and who is now my wife. Yeah.
Okay.
So my girlfriend at the time got a job at this studio called the Woodshed Studio. And she went in there and got this job with management because she really wanted to be in management. Hmm. She came home one day after a few weeks of working there and said, you know, the house engineer is leaving and there's a spot open. And I told them that you can, you know, come in and apply for the job.
So wait a minute. So did the two of you move from Ottawa to Toronto just because she was taking this job?
Largely, yes.
You went to Toronto, I'm guessing, with no job and were... As you're telling the story you're telling right now, we're trying to figure out, okay, she's working at Woodshed Studio. What am I going to do?
Yeah. So, you know, I've always been somebody who I always put the sense of freedom and your ideas and your dreams first, and then you figure out how to make them happen.
Mm.
And I find that throwing yourself into the fire is the best way to do that. And so when I moved to Toronto, yeah, I didn't have any, you know, sort of work lined up.
Okay.
But I was confident enough, you know, in my abilities and being able to find new musicians to work with, you know, going from the recording friends for beer to, you know, was getting paid. By the time I went to Toronto, I'd already had a 2 Juno nominations.
Wow.
And so I had worked my way up in my little home studio up there. So I came to Toronto, you know, having some abilities, you know, that I could offer for sure. So that's why, you know, I'll just say my wife now, you know, she said, you know, hey, I've got this opportunity for you to come in there. And she said, the only thing is they don't believe in computers. There's no Pro Tools in there that you know how to use. There's just tape machine and a big Neve board. And I had never used anything like that.
Oh, boy.
And she said, yeah, but she said, I told them you could do it. So I was like, wow, okay. And she's like, there's this artist named Bruce Coburn coming in. He was very big in Canada, had one big hit in the U.S. way back when, but he was a major artist, and you're going to be assisting on it, and you got to basically set everything up and know how it all works. And I was like, thanks, honey. So, you know, and thrilled, but it's scared, you know, like a little puppy. And so I thankfully had a friend who had a very similar console and also used tape machine. And I phoned him up, and I'm like, Matt, you've got to help me out here, man. Can I just come over? Beer comes into it again. I'll bring you beer, you know, and stuff. He's like, come on over, and I'll run it through. So I wrote everything down that he was describing to me, understanding half of it. The half that I understood was Pro Tools mimics analog. So I understood the technicalities of it.
I
would never have even considered it if I wasn't, you know, I didn't know how to get good sound, didn't understand how the recording process worked. But, you know, I knew that I should be able to figure this out. I got 10 days or a week or whatever. And I'd never had a panic attack before. I don't think I've had one since, but I did that week. And just woke up in the middle of the night just freaking out, you know, had some weird dreams and stuff. And that's how stressful it was. And so I went into the studio on the day that they showed up. And, you know, I had just aligned the tape machine and got everything, you know, trying to make the electrons go where they're supposed to go with the little wires, you know, the batch cables. And so anyway, even at the moment that I was getting the tape machine done, I was like, do I turn the pot clockwise or counterclockwise?
Wow.
Anyways, the head engineer says, okay, Chris, are you ready? You done? The whole band's in there. Everyone's set up, ready to go. The producer's in the producer chair. Everyone's looking at me. And I'm like, yep. You know, heart beating like a little chihuahua. And he said, okay, well, let's run a tone and, you know, check the levels. And all the needles went to where they should. And he goes, good job. Oof. So I walked out of there thinking, oh, I got myself a job. But that was, you know, took a couple of years off my life. But anyway, I ended up building into it once I had worked there and was able to work with some people like Chris Christopherson and Blue Rodeo and Garth Hudson from the band and, you know, assisted on records like Feist Record. And there was, did some guitar tracks for a Bryan Adams record with the guitar player. I basically ended up going to the Blue Rodeo, who owned the studio, going to one of the band's members' house for dinner to celebrate the latest Juno that we had all just won on his record. And I told him the story after some wine about how I got the job there, you know, that basically I didn't know how to use your gear, and I kind of said I did and all that. And he looked at me real serious, and I thought, oh, shoot, I shouldn't have. You know,
yeah.
And he broke out laughing. He's just like, ha ha, just playing with you. Good job. Lifted the Juno up and we cheers.
Wow. So. Wow. Very cool. What a great story. What a great story. A lot of people say that we returned to normalcy 2 days ago, Monday, January 6th, due to the way the calendar fell with Christmas and New Year's Day being on a Wednesday. So now all of a sudden it's January 8th, which means that next week it's time for me to already get back on the road. I can't set this as a New Year's goal because it involves your participation, but I would really love to meet you somewhere during my travels throughout 2025 to say thank you, chat about this show, and just have a nice face-to-face connection. So next week, I will be in Orlando at PodFest Multimedia Expo. That event is January 16th to the 19th. For more details, go to podfestexpo.com. I will be one of the speakers there. I won't even be home for 48 hours after that because on January 21st, I fly out west to attend the massive NAMM show, which takes place in California at the huge Anaheim Convention Center. That is the National Association of Music Merchants. Go to NAMM.org for more information. On Sunday, January 26th, I will drive from Anaheim up to Los Angeles and then fly back home to Tampa Bay on Wednesday, the 29th. The next week, I will be in Northern California, specifically February 6 to 9. I will be at the 21st San Francisco Writers Conference as one of the speakers for that event. That is writers of literature, books, not music. Go to sfwriters.org for more details. If you or someone you know are or will be in Orlando, Anaheim, Los Angeles, or San Francisco as described, email me or DM me on social media, and let's make plans to meet. Chris, you were talking about your time at Woodshed Studio, which went from 2003 to 2012, you worked with major label and indie artists there, but I'm curious to hear about this frustration that came over you relative to a lack of attention given to indie artists, and then what that led you to discover and then offer.
Yeah. So basically, you know, on the one hand, I wasn't one of these people who would see a poster on a pole that says support indie music. You know, come and see indie music. Everyone should be supporting indie music. I thought, well, yeah, okay, I agree with that. But, you know, you also have to be good. It's just the way it is. You've got to be able to attract the people with your music, not just because you're an indie artist and you want help, you know. So on the one hand, I was a little bit like that. On the other hand, I would work in the studio with indie artists who I thought, you know, had some promise or talent and, you know, were going somewhere. Often I would cut my rate to do it. And so when I wasn't working with the major label artists, I was working with some indie artists that I thought were really cool. And their music was basically as good as the major label artists.
Wow.
But the problem was, is they didn't have like the managers and the agents and the labels propelling their career along, right? There was nothing that would happen after the album was done. You know, the artwork would get done if it was, you know, back when it was CDs and stuff, and then start putting it online and getting everything ready. Like, okay, I got to get my, you know, aggregator to send it out to all these places and get everything ready. The release would happen, friends and family, maybe a party at a club, a couple showcases, and then crickets. Nothing would happen, you know, because there was nobody that would promote it, and there was no budget. There was nothing that was going on with it. So I started looking at that and thinking, man, you know, this is frustrating, not only for the indie artists, but also I'm a part of the team too. I'm putting my blood, sweat, and tears into these records, and they're just not going anywhere. So it was right around then I was looking around, I had this itch, you know, and I was looking around thinking, how, what can fix this? And I thought, you know, well, maybe you should try to hook them up labels and whatever. It was right around then that I started hearing about, you know, this new thing that, you know, some indie artists were doing called sync licensing. And people were actually, where before it wasn't cool to get your music into a show, right, on TV, because it was like a cable show. A lot of that stuff was produced to the lowest common denominator, not all of it, but there was a big chunk of it. And it was kind of force-fed to you. You know, you sort of had to, you know, if you wanted to see your show, you had to show up at 8 p.m. and watch it once a week, and there was no ability to bounce around or do anything. You had to watch the ads and everything like that. And so it just wasn't cool. But then when, you know, the cable count grew and then streaming started coming on, there were all these cool shows and people started saying, man, I can get my music into TV and film and I can reach this amazing audience and they're my favorite shows. So I started hearing about artists, like, you know, one in particular came and got a sync and they were just like, yeah, I basically paid my rent for the year from one placement. Wow. And I was like, what, you know? So started looking into it. And realized very quickly that, this was a fantastic avenue for indie songwriters, because it wasn't just the money, you know, which you often get paid thousands of dollars in an upfront sync fee if you get a good sync in a network TV show or movie or whatever. It was also the massive exposure that you can get, you know, because if you've got, like, think about it, like 4 million, 2 million people watching a huge show, let's say just even a million or, you know, what, 800,000, and a fraction of those, I don't know, 200,000 people are Shazamming you and looking for you, your music, because they just heard it in this cool scene on the show. That's a huge amount of exposure. And, you know, so that was the big impetus to start doing
it. Okay. Yeah. Well, in 2012, you and your wife relocated to Los Angeles. So first of all, what was the impetus for the move? Because here you are talking about that you're at Woodshed Studio and you're starting to find out about this thing called sync licensing and saying, this is the way I need to help some of these people go so that my blood, sweat, and tears helps them pay off and get the exposure that they want. But then secondly, talk about how you ended up pivoting once you got out to Los Angeles.
Yeah. So the pivot, it was interesting because the motivation to move to LA was sort of twofold. I guess it's really one with two sort of flavors. The main one was something that happens to both my wife and I on a regular basis, is that we, once we've been doing something for long enough, we start getting a little bored if there's not a growth trajectory, like a curve to it, you know? And in a way, our life in Toronto was almost too good. Like we had a great bunch of friends that we could call family. We lived in, you know, a nice part of town. Our hours were really great. We got paid well and things were going great. So normally people would think, oh, that's perfect.
Yeah, I'm dying to hear where this is going, because as you're saying this, I'm furrowing my brow. Like, why would you leave that? So I'm dying to hear what you're going to say, because it seems like everything was letter perfect and no reason to leave. And here you are about to tell us that you up and left the country, not to mention went from the East Coast to the West Coast.
Yeah. So the thing was, nothing was changing very much. You know, I was working with the same bands, and, you know, we were kind of not, you know, it wasn't like this big progression in music. You know, we were sort of in the more the roots, you know, Americana side of things, rock side of things. And it just, you know, they were doing great. They were writing all excellent new songs and stuff, but it felt a little bit like making the same records over and over and over again.
Wash, you know? Rinse, repeat.
Yeah, kind of, you know, and this is nothing on the artists at all, because they were obviously writing brand new songs, which wasn't the thing I was doing. Just my production, it was like, hey, we're this band, this is our sound, this is what we want to do. So I was kind of going after the same sounds, going after the same set kind of thing, and sometimes would get a resistance if I tried to, you know, push a little too hard, and like, hey, maybe we should try this, you know? Mm-hmm. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And so, I, you know, it just felt like, man, you know, it was kind of like, you know, that thing in The Matrix when they talked about where the computer's talking to the, they said, we built The Matrix earlier and made it perfect, but the humans rebelled against it. It had to be flawed. It was like a little bit like that.
Okay.
It was just, things were just kind of too perfect. So, and also, this is the second flavor of that, is that because we were sort of getting into the sync angle of things and all of that, there are far more music supervisors who are the people who put music into TV and film in LA than there are in Canada, or at least the shows are much, much bigger. Mm-hmm. And so we just saw a brand new opportunity. Really, we wanted to kind of, you know, jump up a level and go to the kind of the Mecca for that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So you get in LA and then you pivoted once you got out there.
Yeah, so there was a physical pivot, not a philosophical pivot. The physical pivot happened because my wife and I got pregnant with our daughter, you know, and that, like, for those of you who don't have children, which I didn't have children before either, I completely understand, you might be thinking, wow, you know, that's a big change for just having a kid, like whatever. It really, for most of us, you know, who have had kids, the people I know, it really changes your life in like the most amazing way. And we're just hardwired for this thing. And you don't know the hardwire's there until you have the kid. And you realize, oh, my God, well, evolution hid something in here. And you just now want to really, you know, just incorporate everything about that being a parent into your life. So we didn't want to be in sort of a smoggy city while, you know, she was really, you know, an infant. I didn't want to be spending 12 to 14-hour days in studios anymore. I wanted to be able to be there to, you know, raise her and just be around, you know, to experience her growing up and stuff.
Yeah.
So we're like, well, okay, let's try to move everything online. I'm just going to stop doing it. So we bought a Westfalia van, packed it up, and went to Discover America and started an online studio, which is I still have, which is, you know, much more developed now. And the sync thing was a little on the back burner, but it was always in my mind about, like, how do we produce music for that and all that. And we took off in the van heading east and just to sort of live on the road, find America. And then when our daughter would be born, we would, you know, set everything up for that wherever we were, or, you know, go to Canada or something like that.
So let's fast forward to 2017. As I had mentioned, 2012 is when you and your wife relocated to Los Angeles. 2017, an audience, you're seeing how this is all building towards what Chris is heading up today. That year, Chris, 2017, you launched something as the culmination of the relationship building that you had been doing.
Yeah. So I'll fill in the gap for you. Between 2012 and 2017, we had amazing adventures. We traveled all over the place and we did lots of fun stuff, drove up the West Coast in the van up to Vancouver and back and all that. So that was fun. But we were bleeding money because we were failing badly.
Oh, no.
Online things. Like, we just didn't know what we were doing. You know, it was like we didn't have any clue in how this thing worked, you know? So it was like, oh yeah, you put a website up and then, you know, then what? Well, whatever, let's just start there. You know, we were getting by, you know, for sure. Of course, we had a daughter, we had to make sure we had enough money. There was some remote work too. My wife was still working for the management company in Canada remotely for some stuff. I was doing a few other little things and we're bringing in enough money to, you know, live and provide and be safe and stuff. But we were not making any progress with our online entrepreneurial dreams. But gradually, you know, I took some courses, learned a lot more about how to, you know, get your message out there, you know, and how to do that and how to build a site and how to get clients online and how, you know, all of this stuff. And so by the time 2016 was really very beginnings of it, where we kind of did these little soft launches and stuff. And 2017 was the big solid launch, but that was kind of like, you know, those bands who have the hit song,
yeah,
and you're like, oh, they came out of nowhere. It's like, no, they were slogging it out for 6 years before that. You just didn't know that. So it was kind of like that.
And that was when you launched something called The Art of the Song Pitch, 2017, yes?
Yeah, and that was basically because I had been working with artists in the studio and artists I was working with and helping them get their music into TV and film. And I thought, how can I help more indie songwriters? How can I open this up and work with people kind of from around the world and not just work with a few of them, work with more of them? And that's when I created the Art of the Song Pitch program. And basically the whole thing about it is teaching everybody what they need to know about how to get music into TV and film. Nothing more. They don't have to become lawyers. It's really easy and straightforward. But the most important part is I actually introduce them directly to the right people in TV and film. So I introduce them directly to the music supervisor. So I'm not a middleman. I want the actual indie artists to make contacts with the people who are normally impossible to get a hold of.
Wow, yeah.
And that's really what it's about.
Wow, wow. I'm joined today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from just outside of Nashville by award-winning songwriter and producer Chris SD. Stick around to hear about the service I mentioned in the intro. Spoiler alert, the website is syncsongwriter.com. I will have a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. There are links on syncsongwriter.com to engage through social media, meaning Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. You're also going to want to head to sundownsessionsstudio.com. I know there are questions about S's or lack thereof in that URL, so I will have a link for that too on the show page for this episode on nhte.net. Meanwhile, this coming Sunday, January 12th, there is a free online live event at 10 a.m. Pacific time, which is 1 p.m. Eastern time, which Chris is about to give details on. As I said earlier, when I was giving out my quote-unquote tour dates, we are already up to January 8th, which means the clock has started ticking on those New Year's resolutions that you made. Maybe you have been listening to this show for a while and have said, I have to finally download and install and set up that app that Bruce is always talking about. And or maybe you just flat out told yourself, I'm going to make concerted efforts to make more meaningful, more helpful connections in 2025 to help me move my career ahead. Either way, make the time to download the OWL app. That's OWL like the bird, except with two W's and two L's. It is a social networking platform that connects people instantly through private one-on-one audio calls. That's a fancy way of saying that you can use your phone, you can use the app to call people who you see on there that can benefit you and whatever it is that you're doing. There are experts from a wide range of industries. And by the way, once you get on there, now you are an expert who's available for people to call on there. Here is how to activate all of this. On my podcast website, nhte.net, tap or click where it says news and then read the article under the headline, Help Now a Phone App Call Away. There are links in that article to download OWL for free from the App Store or Google Play. You will also see my invitation code in there. That is a required field as you're setting up the app on your phone. Download it, call me, and let's talk. Chris, let's talk about what you have coming up this Sunday, January 12th. For starters, just tell the audience first what this event is, and then separately, I'm going to be coming back and asking you where online they can go to quote-unquote attend, and I'm also going to be asking you about some of the folks who they'll hear from. But right now, just share about what the event actually is first before I come back with those follow-up questions.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that I wanted to allow indie songwriters to do was be able to sort of discover who are these gatekeepers, who are the people in TV and film who control the music getting into TV and film. And those are called music supervisors. So essentially, directors and producers are too busy, you know, with the storylines and the production and the, all this other stuff that goes on in movies and TV. They hire people to go after the music for all the scenes, and those are the music supervisors. So I have a lot of friends who are music supervisors, and that's how we've gotten so many sync placement results at Sync Songwriter, is by me introducing indie songwriters directly to these music supervisors. So every year, I like to have this music supervisor panel. It's called the Sync Songwriter Music Supervisor Panel. And I invite five of my friends, five top music supervisors, to come on and talk about indie music, like how they use indie music, what they're looking for right now, where do they find their indie music and stuff like that. So it gives people a chance to kind of really like learn from the actual people who are there and get to know who they are, you know. And I'm talking about music supervisors who work on like Grey's Anatomy, Bridgerton, Will Trent, The Penguin, Poker Face, Reasonable Doubt, Supernatural, Crazy Rich Asians, the Anora Cannes Film Festival, Palme d'Or winning movie. I helped two musicians get five tracks into that. So this is really where the magic happens. And I want indie songwriters to be able to connect directly with them. And the first step to do that is to find out who they are.
So then what is the format of this event this coming Sunday? Is it just you and them, quote unquote, talking at the audience? Or is it, you know, you can ask questions in the chat? Just kind of explain a little bit more what that's going to look like for the people. And I'm assuming that it's not something that's 5 or 10 minutes long. I'm assuming that this is probably like, you know, 30 minutes, maybe, if not longer.
Yeah, it's an hour long.
Wow.
And so we'll be talking about stuff, and there'll also be a Q&A. It's going to be a lot of Q&A, actually,
okay,
to get real questions from real people. It's the biggest, as far as we know, the biggest event in our space that happens every year. And we have over 10,000 musicians who sign up to attend.
Whoa.
This thing. It's free, of course.
Whoa.
And so we've got lots of people wanting to discover sort of, you know, how to get their music into TV and film. This is the place to do it, you know, because you're talking to the people who do it, essentially.
So where online do people go for this coming Sunday? And do they just show up at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern? Or is it you need to, quote unquote, register in advance, even though it's free?
Yeah, so basically the best thing to do is literally head over to syncsongwriter.com, and right there there'll be a little sign up to grab your spot. And then we'll, you know, give you all the information about it, and you'll be sure to have the link, and you just literally show up on Sunday, essentially.
I see. Okay. When I was giving out your online destinations, I not only highlighted the website and social media for Sync Songwriter, but I mentioned the web address for Sundown Sessions Studio. I want to be sure that is still very much operating and open for business, correct? Meaning it wasn't a case of, no, I shut that down when I launched Sync Songwriter. Assuming that I'm right, tell us more about Sundown Sessions Studio.
Yeah. So basically the studio was the very first thing that I started, you know, starting to try to build back in, you know, 2010, 2012, or whatever. And that has grown and grown, and we've recorded people from all over the world. We've gotten people on, you know, on radio, TV and film. People have gotten label deals, publishing deals with music that we've helped them do. And I have an amazing team of players and co-producers and things like that. And we work to basically take, you know, music from indie songwriters and turn it into world-class records, but with an indie budget, essentially. That's kind of what we do.
Mm.
And we work with a lot of people who we help get their music into TV and film. We produce a lot of their music as well. And like these first, you know, two songs we were just talking about, those have been synced, you know, one in Grey's Anatomy and another one in another show, kind of thing. And so that's kind of what we do at the studio, is a part of that. You don't have to record with me to work with me to get your music into TV and film, but it's there if you're sort of wanting to get music a little bit, you know, up to standards kind of thing.
Yeah, that's what my follow-up question was going to be, is so many people try to DIY it these days, and specifically with regards to recording themselves at home, some obviously are better than others. For the folks who can be honest enough with themselves to say, okay, this is a good start, but it's not radio ready, or who knows, maybe they even say it's not even Spotify ready, do you offer the ability for artists to send you, here's what I recorded on my own, can you please help it sound better production-wise, or is that, am I misunderstanding the services that you offer through Sundown Session Studio?
That's pretty much the service right there.
Okay.
That's exactly what we do. Yeah, we love working with people who are talented songwriters, but who are not ready yet to produce records, you know? And it doesn't mean you're not going to get there. It just takes time. You know, you got to just work at it. But in the meantime, this is the thing that I always say to people if they're mulling it over, thinking, well, you know, maybe I should just, you know, not spend the money on like working with Chris or another, you know, studio, and I should just, you know, work at home for free.
Yeah.
You know, everything costs, right? So it's either your time or someone else is going to do it for you, and you're going to spend the money. You're paying for it both ways. But the worst part about doing it at home, if you're not ready, is that you're wasting great songs on mediocre production, meaning that you might have these amazing songs that could do all kinds of things for you. They're probably worth as much as a car, and you're kind of you're taking all this time to do it, and then you're releasing it, and it can't go anywhere because it's not the best it can be, you know? So my advice is always work with another producer while you're learning, and you're going to learn from them too. Like you're going to hear what they did. You'll get there, but in the meantime, try to work with somebody who can make your great songs do amazing things, because the production part's like, you know, you can learn that as you go. Songwriting is much harder. So focus on the thing that you're really good at and then learn the production as you go. But then you've got all these things happening. If you waste 2 years, you know, trying to produce yourself and you're not really hitting the mark, then that's 2 years where your songs aren't doing anything. Mm. And if you instead work with a production team or something, and you, those same songs at the end of 2 years, you could have like syncs in TV, you could have made thousands of dollars. You might have a record deal. It's all kinds of stuff that can happen for you, you know?
But Chris, both yourself and the audience, show me a little grace, because I'm not sure that I'm clear on the following. If there's someone out there who has written what they feel are some great songs, and they contact you and say, I've got these great songs I've written, can you get them recorded for me? Can you bring in players? Or is it, no, Bruce, we don't start from scratch. You got to bring us songs that have already been recorded in some fashion. Do you actually start from scratch and say, sure, send us the songs and we'll get some players. We'll even get, you know, someone to come in and sing on it if you need it. Or is that totally off the mark?
So that is a great question, because it's actually the opposite of what you were thinking. What it was is essentially we only start from scratch.
Oh.
So we don't work with any pre-recorded tracks. And the reason being is we used to, and we had services. You know, you could come to us just for mastering, or if you need a guitar player, we can do that, or if you need just mixing. But the problem was is that there was no quality control on what we were getting, you know?
Yeah.
And there was a lot of sometimes fixing it in the mix, or, you know, things weren't recorded right, or they were disorganized, or there were like 17, you know, like tambourine tracks, and, you know, and just trying to figure out which is the take. And it just was like, no. Okay. We've got to be like just a one-stop shop. We do it from scratch. So we're in full control of how the song is built up, and we know it's going to be great. And I don't say that as like some egotistical like statement, like, oh, you think you're so great. I say that because I'm not the only one who works on this music, but you're talking about people who have been doing it forever at a high level, right? You can't help but be great when you get there. So it's just like someone listening, a lot of you listening here, you're in a band and you play. If you've been touring for a little while, you know you can't suck anymore. You can't, because you've been doing it for too long. You can't get, you might have a good show and a better show, but you're never going to have a bad show where people are going to be like, oh my gosh, you know, this band can't play, right? So it's just like that, is that if you hire people or work with people who have already been doing it for a long time, you're always going to get something that's going to be great. The question just comes down to the direction. There could be disagreements on like the approach, right, to the music. And that's things that we talk to the people, clients, I guess you can call them, you know, musicians about that we work with. We go through that. They get free, like, you know, we kind of mock up the song. What do you think of this? You know, they're like, I don't really like that. Oh, no problem. We'll do something different, you know, until we're all high-fiving and we're like, boom, yeah, this sounds great, guys. Let's keep rolling. Yeah.
So just so that we don't have somebody hear this interview and contact you and try to put you on the spot, if they say, what do you use, Chris? And it's, you know, Pro Tools or Logic or whatever. And they say, well, I use that too. Why can't I just send you my project file? And you can go in and clean up the guitar track for me or the vocal track or whatever. It sounds like you're saying, you know, we tried that. It doesn't work. You know, you may say you have the project file, but I know in my experience from doing these, yeah, that's why we don't operate that way anymore.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in rare cases, we've taken some music that we know is top shelf, you know, production and done a few things. But yeah, our general policy is basically you're better off, honestly, going on a website and finding somebody else who will do that kind of stuff for you.
Okay.
We're just not the people who do that. But if you want to send us a song, like, you know, for example, I took a song from a woman. She sent it on her smartphone, just her vocal on her smartphone, just a little recording. And we produced that. She got four sync placement.
Whoa.
Like we produced it from scratch, you know, and four sync placements. Boom. You know?
Wow.
So that's kind of what we love to do.
Okay. Okay. I'm curious, this is a little off topic, and maybe you already answered it when I asked you about the move out to LA, but when and why did you relocate to Tennessee?
You know, we always loved Tennessee. We always thought it was pretty cool. Like, we love the state and the, you know, just, it's always a cool vibe. We go to Nashville and stuff and always really enjoyed ourselves and everything. And we've been in California for, you know, geez, about like 10 years maybe. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just like our move from Toronto, right, to LA, we moved from LA to Tennessee just to change things up.
Yeah,
you know,
it was just time.
We love California, but it was time. We just wanted to change, you know, and kind of get out of California for a bit and do that. And one little interesting note, though, is when we moved to California, when the business started doing better, instead of paying rent in an apartment, we actually bought a sailboat, and we lived on a sailboat in Marina Del Rey. And then business did better, and then so we bought a bigger boat. We took it down to Mexico for a year and a half, and then we still have the boat on the coast. So we kind of go between our place. So we're in East Tennessee up near the Smoky Mountains. So we go between sort of the Smoky Mountains and sailing, and that's perfect. Like, that's a nice balance. We can't afford to have a big sailboat and a mansion on a California coast there or anything like that, but we can certainly afford to have a small place in the Smoky Mountains and go back and forth. You know, we live the life we want to live.
Too cool. Too cool. We're in the home stretch here. It's always fun to hear someone that has worked with artists at the level you have do some storytelling. Kris Kristofferson, Bryan Adams, Garth Hudson, is there one fun story that jumps out at you that you would share with us? And it doesn't have to be one of those three gentlemen. It could be anyone, but I'm sure that there's probably half a dozen that you could tell if I gave you that much time. But if you could just pick out one to share with us.
I think the one that, you know, was one of the nicest stories that happened, you know, to me, and it was very indirect, but it just had a big impact on me, was, as I said, when I was a teenager, you know, I listened to a lot of 60s music. I kind of skipped over the 80s for just my own tastes and went straight to the 90s. So I was into the kind of 60s and early 70s bands. And, you know, Beatles fan, of course, you know, mainly of their later stuff. So I was in the studio and was doing those guitar tracks for the Bryan Adams record with the guitar player. And we were trying to go after a certain sound. And so I finally ended up putting a little tiny amp on a chair. It was like a Champ or something, and put a U47 kind of a certain distance back from it. And I was looking for a particular sound. And it was like, boom, there it is, you know? And we finally nailed it. So we got this really cool sound on the record, and then whatever, that was done. So this guitar player ends up being, I think it was actually, he was Bryan Adams' guitar player. So he ends up going, I think it was with Bryan Adams, to England for this like Sgt. Pepper's anniversary record. Hmm. So they invited a bunch of artists to record. Each one would record a track from Sgt. Pepper's. So they ended up, you know, at Abbey Road. And of course, the Abbey Road had brought in Jeff Emerick, who is like one of the main Beatles engineers, you know, for a lot of their sort of seminal stuff. And so the guitar player is in there chatting with him and, you know, talking about this, that, and the other thing. And Jeff's like, okay, you know, you ready? And I said, yep. So he sets him up and he takes this little amp, sticks it on the chair, takes a U47, puts it about the same distance I did. And the guitar player goes, hey, you know, I just literally recorded some stuff back in Toronto with this guy, and he did exactly the same thing, you know, whatever. And Jeff said, oh, he's a smart guy. He said, well, I used to record a lot of the Beatles guitar players like that.
Whoa.
You know, good guitarists. So, you know, I mean, it's kind of like a cheap story about, like, you know, he doesn't know me and whatever. And I finally came to it after an hour of trying to figure things out and stuff like that. But it was just such a cool connection, you know, for me in the moment, you know, to be like, huh, you know, I kind of got a little bit of that feeling of like, okay, I was in the same sort of same thought patterns as some of the things that were going on at the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, not that it was validation for you, because the validation came when the guitar player and Bryan Adams were happy with it. But then when you do hear that, well, if it worked for the Beatles, then clearly I was on the right track, even though I already, you know, had it confirmed by the guitar player and Bryan being happy with it.
Yeah, exactly. So there you go. And very, very quickly, if you have time for one more quick story that just popped into my head, for those songwriters out there, which I think is a really good lesson.
Please.
So when my brother and I first started our band, we went to Toronto from Ottawa. We went down to Toronto to go to some big conference. You know, we were going to go down there. We were going to meet some industry folks. That's what we thought. Right? We'll go to a big city and meet all these, like, you know, record execs or something. I didn't know what we were doing. But we just went down there to the conference. And we were a little late. So we show up and we're walking in the door. And one of the keynote speakers was Malcolm McLaren, the late ex-manager of the Sex Pistols. And so he was walking out of the, you know, the room, the conference room, when we were walking into the building. And he's coming down the hallway to leave, you know, go at the big glass doors. And he's got his entourage around him, and he's walking towards us. And I'm thinking, man, this is the moment. Seize the moment. Let's just, you know. So I kind of stepped in front of him, blocked his way a bit, and said, Malcolm, really quick, just do you have any advice for a band just starting out what we should do, you know? And he looked at my brother and I standing there. And you know those lanyards you wear around at the conference with your name on it and stuff? He went over and pulled the one off my brother and he threw it on the floor.
Whoa.
And he looked at us, and in his kind of, you know, my terrible British accent, he goes, first of all, you don't come to them. You go home and write great songs and make them come to you.
Wow.
So it's like, well, it's basically, what are you doing here? What are you doing at this conference?
Wow.
Just go home and become great. Do great things and they will come to you. You know, and that's what you need to do, not chase them. That always stuck in my mind, and I always use that in many different ways about, like, if you focus on the things that you're, what you want to do, and you just do the very best that you can do, and you've got something that is great. It's not a quite the build it and they will come thing, but when you show up to opportunities and you have the thing that is going to kind of make it happen, then that's when the magic happens, you know? It's like when I got my job, right, at that first studio, I didn't trick my way in there. Well, maybe a little bit. But I showed up prepared. I was already a good engineer, and I already had some nominations under my belt. I knew what I was doing. So I had worked hard in that studio recording Friends for Beer, you know, and got myself to a position where when I did show up and an opportunity came up, it looked a little like, wow, this guy walks off the street and he gets this great job, you know. And I think for songwriters out there, it's important to just work on your craft, play live as much as you can, really keep writing and challenging yourself, co-write, do all these things to make you better and better until you'll know when you're good enough. And when you're good enough, because you'll know it, that's when you start going after these opportunities. And that's when you can make the bell ring, because you've got both things, right? You've got a nice big mallet now, and the bell's sitting there waiting for you. So that's the advice I got from Malcolm, and it was it's always stuck with me.
Yeah, and the conversation we've had to this point will bear that out, because you've already given, indirectly, two examples of that mindset of they will come to you. One is that you said, don't waste time on poor production when you might be sitting on these great songs. Get the great quality production that those songs deserve, right? So that's what's going to attract people to you. And the second thing is, by finally getting these songs placed in film and television, now people are going to go, who is this XYZ band? This song is really good. We get to see what else they're doing. So you're practicing what you preach, or what Malcolm preached, but great lesson. We're going to close today with another song that Chris worked on called Reflections. Before I let you go and we play that track, share with us all about this one, Chris, if you would please. Who the artist is, what your role was with this one, just any insights about this song that we would be interested in learning before we hear it.
Yeah, sure. So this is a song by Ships Have Sailed, and it's another artist that I've helped get their music into TV and film, or, you know, introduce them to the real gatekeepers. TV and film, this one got into Grey's Anatomy. He's actually had three placements in Grey's Anatomy, among others. So yeah, he's just a perfect example of somebody who, you know, started, you know, where he started, and then he just worked on his craft, and then we had the good chance of working together, and boom, things have really taken off for him. So yeah, this one, we sort of produced a version of this one in our studio for him, and yeah, got in Grey's Anatomy, and we just approached it with the very sort of similar vibe. He's already, of course, very much like this. You know, we weren't doing any radical changes. We were basically doing kind of him, you know, but we always had a mind for TV and film, you know, what would work, and it worked.
But I'm curious, because I have been referring to you as a songwriter and producer, you said at the very beginning of this show, that Change of Heart, the song that we played at the beginning, that you said, you know, that you were thinking like a Tom Petty vibe. But I wonder, when someone is bringing you a song, and maybe that song is Reflections, is the songwriter in you really rolling up your sleeves, or is it, I pretty much lead with my producer hat, Bruce? I don't suggest a whole lot of, I don't want to say rewrite it, meaning the whole song, but changing a lyric, changing a bridge, changing whatever it is, or is it, oh yeah, I very much get involved as a songwriter in songs that are brought to me?
Yeah, so I don't actually get involved as a songwriter in terms of the copyright. So I'm not sitting there co-writing parts with the artists. And I mean, I'm a songwriter at heart. That's how I started out and everything like that. What I do is I bring my songwriting to the production, which means that I think everyone can relate to this. When you're writing a song and you come up with a good part, you know it's good. Right? You get that kind of tingle, you're just like, ooh, that was good. Where's my tape recorder? Where's my phone? Whatever. You got to write it down, or whatever you got to do. And you got not lose it. And you just know in your heart of hearts. And then you're like, wow, okay, how do I make the chorus live up to this awesome verse, And so when I'm listening to production and I'm listening to the song, it's very easy for me to find the emotion in the song because I'm a songwriter. I understand kind of where the nuance is and what the song is trying to say. Not like what's going to just make it sound good, but like where's the emotion? Because the most important thing in music production is essentially kind of boils down to two things when you're first starting out. One, the most important in my mind is capturing the emotion of the song. Like literally kind of doesn't matter how you produce it, as long as the hair stand up a little bit when you're listening to it. And you're just like, oh my gosh. Because if it does that for you, it's going to do that for others. And that's the most important part. The second most important part to me is trying to make sure that you sort of stick to a little bit of a familiarity with a twist. Meaning that don't try to reinvent the wheel just because you think you're being clever. Like it's like, I'm just going to go to 6/8 in the chorus because I think it's just a smart thing to do. And it's like, whatever. It's like, if you just stayed like at 4/4, I mean, are you going to just deliver the song in a better way? And that was sort of an example of that Change of Heart song. It's like Tom Petty is so simple and straightforward. So it's not like I wanted Rob to sound like Tom Petty. That wasn't what motivated it. I heard the song and I thought this song's message gets delivered in that kind of very simple Tom Petty-ish kind of way.
Okay.
And that's how the songwriting informed the production.
I like it. Chris, wonderful to have you on the show. Really good stuff. I appreciate you making time to be on Now Hear This Entertainment.
Yeah, Bruce, thanks so much for having me. This is fantastic.
My pleasure. And audience, with that, I will wrap up another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. My sincere thanks to award-winning songwriter and producer Chris S.D. Again, do visit syncsongwriter.com. As I mentioned earlier, I will have a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. On his website, you will see social media links for Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. I followed him this morning on Instagram. I'm sure he would appreciate you doing the same with one or more of those four. Plus, you heard Chris talking about the live event coming up this Sunday, January 12th at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. No cost to quote-unquote attend, so do make plans to be a part of that. Remember as well about sundownsessionsstudio.com. I will have a link for that too on nhte.net. We are into a new year, but yes, I'm still saying it because I still mean it. I do hope that you like this show, that you're enjoying what I'm doing every week on the Now Hear This Entertainment podcast. If you've made it all the way to the end, thank you for having stuck with Chris and I, and I'm going to assume that that means that you do like the podcast. You can take action to let me know that you appreciate the work that I do to keep making this show happen every week, every month, almost 11 years now without missing once, by going on my podcast website, nhte.net, and then using the yellow Buy Me a Coffee logo that you will see there. This is not a sponsor. It's not affiliated with any brand or chain. It's just a fun way for you to send your support, your thanks to me, including a note that I will see when you utilize that option. You can also just head directly to buymeacoffee.com/BruceW. That's going to do it for episode 569. Thanks ever so much for listening. I'll send you out today with a song that Chris produced. This is the one he just talked about. It's Ships Have Sailed song called Reflections.
Moonless tonight, shattered the stars and all that's left behind. Is this a spark, or is it a hope we find ourselves inside? Embers built into a fire, like gold in your eyes. We're tiny islands in the night. reflected light. We are the light. Maybe we'll fall to the ground and burn the whole world down. But while we're alive, light up the skies, we rise. Of your heart, quietly guarding the fire, suspended in time. We're tiny islands in the night, reflected light. We are the light. Maybe we'll fall to the ground and burn the whole world down. While we're to the ground.